Welcome to the third lecture, and I will just invite Janardhan to start on illusion as mislocated seeing.
Oh, thank you, Asana. The Nyaya philosopher Udyotakara makes two claims about illusion. First, that illusions are always partial, that although they involve an erroneous determination, the determination is made with respect to an object with which the perceiver stands in a genuine perceptual relationship. And second, that illusion consists in the imposition of something upon this object, so that the perceiver sees in it something which isn't there. Udyotakara's reason for making these claims is that if the realist is to be in a position to resist the view of those who would argue that all human experience is dreamlike in quality, and as such makes no contact with the external world, it must do so by demonstrating that the nature of illusion is to be such that illusion can always be corrected or annulled by genuine perceptual experience. The partiality of illusion is its Achilles heel. As Udayana puts it in the Parishuddhi, all experience is inerrant as far as the object is concerned. Motilal's nice term for this object is the nucleus or the anchor of the experience. And there's a popular Nyaya maxim, all experience is inerrant as far as the nucleus is concerned, error rests with how it looks. That is the gist of a very enigmatic and controversial passage in the Nyaya Sutra, Nyaya Sutra 4.2.35-37, which affirms that genuine perceptual experience undercuts perceptual error, just as waking up undercuts dreams, and that erroneous experience is twofold in nature, consisting in part in acquaintance with a real object, tattva, and in part in an imputed counterpart, pradana. Matthew Dasty puts the idea as being that illusion is parasitic on genuine perceptual experience. And Anand Vaidya speaks of the asymmetric dependence of error on truth. But both take the idea to be that erroneous experience as a whole is dependent on veridical experience as a whole, rather than as concerning veridical and non-veridical elements within a single experience. It's the partiality of illusion which, as Vishwanath clarifies in his explanation of the meaning of Nyaya Sutra 4.2.37, undermines the global illusionism. Found in some Indian thinkers contemporaneous with early Nyaya. The thinkers in question have been traced to the Mahayana Lankavatara Sutra. In Funibhushana's summary, Vishwanath's idea is that it cannot be argued that there is no valid cognition, that all cognitions are only false, because even the most well-known cases of false cognitions are observed to be valid in their tattva aspect and false only in their pradana aspect. And that's what's meant by the dual character of an illusory cognition. Illusion depends on the same perceptual connection with a real object, as does genuine perceptual experience. So Udyotakara says that an illusion perceives a person in a tree stump, an illusion which knowledge undermines without undermining the reality of the object itself, the thing that has characteristics common to both persons and tree stumps. we do not conclude that the stump does not exist. It's the same with experiences of things in dreams, which are undermined by waking experience. Again, without undermining the object itself, the thing that has characteristics in common. He continues, illusion has a defining mark, but what is it? The defining mark is perception of what's common, non-perception of what's particular, and imputation of a feature not present. The reality is the stump, the imputed counterpart is the person. Illusion is the burdening or assigning or imputing of the real with the imputed. Illusion then consists in the following three things. First, object selection, selecting an object in virtue of perceptual properties common to both illusion and genuine perception. Then, imputation, burdening the experienced object with an imputed feature it doesn't have. And finally, masking, blindness to perceptual properties that would break the illusion. So let me call these the selection, imputation, and masking conditions. The substance of the account will consist in how the metaphor of burdening, assigning, or imputing a tyaropa is to be cashed out. And what I want to argue in this talk is that the way it gets to be cashed out in Nyaya puts the Nyaya theory at odds with the two main contemporary theories of illusion currently favoured by naive realists, disjunctivism and objective looks theory. It's not disjunctivist because illusions, being at least partially perceptual, do not belong to a wholly non-perceptual mental kind. As Matalal puts it, the perceived character of the snake in our sensory illusion cannot be easily dismissed or underplayed. On the other hand, the minimal commitment of a view that can be labelled a disjunctivist theory of perception, as Sotirio says, is that veridical perceptions, illusions and hallucinations differ mentally in some significant respect, i.e. that there are certain mental features that veridical perceptions have that illusions and hallucinations cannot have. And the Nyaya theory is not an objective looks theory either because, as I'm going to explain in more detail shortly, that theory relegates perceptual error to the realm of the doxastic so that, strictly speaking, there are no such things as illusions. An objective looks theorist wants to say that in any case where an object appears F, it's objectively the case that the object looks F-ish, where the F-ish look worn by the object is as much an objective, albeit situational, property of that object as any of its other properties. So that illusions are alike in that they are opportunities for being misled. With some adjustment, Udyotakura's way of characterising illusion can be made to fit with typical contemporary formulations. Here are three typical ones. A standardly conceived, an illusion is an experience of an object O appearing F, where O is not in fact F, that's Calderon. A visual illusion may be characterised as a perceptual experience in which a physical object O looks F, although O is not actually F, that's Brewer. An illusion is a perceptual situation in which a physical object is actually perceived, but in which that object appears other than it really is, that's Smith. each of these formulations agrees with Udyatakara that illusion is partial. There is, in each case, a perceptual experience of an object. In the recent literature, this feature of illusions, that they are in some sense always partial, is stressed by Smith when he writes, "Inasmuch as illusory perceptions are indeed perceptions, perceptual contact is made with some actual object in the environment, they share a good feature with veridical perceptions. Inasmuch as they're illusory, however, they are in some sense bad." In speaking of how that object looks or appears, the contemporary formulation provides one way of making precise the notion of burdening or imputing. The pradhana F is imputed to the tattva O in the sense that this is a way the object looks. Well, following the lead of Dharmakirti, let's divide illusion into two categories, cognitive and non-cognitive. In the last lecture, I noted that Dharmakirti recognises that there are both, the latter including environmental illusions like the circling fire and the moving boat illusions, and physiological illusions like floaters caused by timura. His taxonomy is echoed in a contemporary classification of illusions into environmental, physiological, and cognitive. So Janone, for example, writes, "There seem to be at least three kinds of illusions. First, those in which environmental conditions, lighting, the medium of sound or light transmission, the presence of surrounding objects, and so on, are responsible for a perceived object appearing other than it is. Environmental illusions of this sort cover many familiar cases of illusions discussed by philosophers and psychologists, including the appearance of a straight stick partially submerged in water, lighting illusions, and the Mulalaya illusion. The second case involved cognitive illusions, for example, when one's looking for a friend in a crowd. Other people who are superficially similar in appearance can briefly look just like the individual being searched for. And finally, physiological illusions involve the improper functioning of a subject's perceptual system, such as cases of objects appearing distorted or discoloured under the influence of drugs or sleep deprivation." Dharmakirti recognises that there are environmental and physiological illusions, as well as cognitive illusions, so that the reduction of illusion to misconceptualization fails. Now, Nyaya Sutra 4.2.32 also seems to provide for a taxonomy of illusion. It reads, "Or it's like magic, cities of Gandharvas, or a mirage." Vatsyayana, in his commentary, wants to emphasize that in every case there is an anchor in the real world. He writes, "Illusions of magic and the like have a material basis. Magic is what happens when a magician produces in the observer the illusion of an object similar to the one being used in the trick. Or one has an experience of a far-off city in something like a cloud which looks similar to a city, for there would be no such experience without the cloud. And when the sun's rays shine on the heat radiating from the earth, one has the illusion of water because something is seen in common. There would be no such experience without the hot earth and the sun's rays. The defining mark of illusion, Vatsyayana says, is a specific condition in terms of where, when, and for whom. If we map the examples of illusion provided in Nya Sutra 4.2.32 onto contemporary classifications, the case of illusion generated by magic and the case of the mirage will be environmental, and the case of seeing a city in the clouds is a cognitive illusion, as indeed is seeing a person in a tree stump, as well as all the canonical examples settled on later, seeing a snake when there's only a coil of rope, and seeing a piece of silver where what there is in actuality is an oyster pearl shell. In fact, however, the early Nya thinkers do not analyse cognitive illusions as misapplications of a concept, and the label cognitive illusion is potentially misleading. The earliest example of such an illusion, the one just mentioned by Vatsyayana in that passage, is an interesting and illuminating one. As Dasty and Phillips note, a city of Gandharvas is the Indian equivalent of a castle in the sky, a cloud formation in the distance that looks like a castle or a city. A natural analysis of such cases would be that they involve make-perceive, the augmentation of reality by means of the superimposition of a mental image. A familiar application of this ability, Briscoe observes, is the experience of noticing a constellation in the nighttime sky. Noticing a constellation is a hybrid visual imaginative experience. It involves both seeing the stars in the constellation and imagining the lines that connect them at the same time. That's the kind of seeing as Dummett calls proto-thought, because its vehicle is mental imagery rather than conceptual content. Likewise, the Buddhist view is, as Jan Westerhoff in his book 12 Examples of Illusion says, and the book includes the Nya 3, that the city of Gandharvas is an entirely imaginary place that, together with its inhabitants, exists only in the human mind. In keeping with his Kantianism, Motilal says that it seems that the Nyaya explanatory model fits in very well with what we might call imaginative error. The standard examples are a silver shell situation and a rope snake situation. The role of similarity and imaginative attribution is almost paradigmatic in such cases. The Nya philosophers are emphatic, however. The imputed feature, the pradhana, in an illusion is not a mental image or an imagined construct, but is itself a mind-independent feature or object. And its imputation is itself a mode of perceptual acquaintance. Later Nayakas will reconceptualize the idea of imputation, aropya, in terms of mislocation, or perhaps better, misallocation. The Nya theory I want to discuss here is that imputed features in illusion are mind-independent properties with which the misperceiver is acquainted, but that contrary objective looks theory, they are not actual properties of the object being misperceived. Nya philosophers point out, in effect, that there's a simple fallacy in the argument from illusion against naive realism. insofar as it assumes falsely that because the feature a perceived object looks to have is not an actual feature of the object itself, it's not available to perceptual acquaintance at all. A standard view among contemporary naive realists is that the naive realist claim that perceptual experience is constituted by acquaintance with an ordinary object and some of its properties entails that there can be no such thing as perceptual error. We call that the perceptual error thesis. Naive realism entails that there's no error in perceptual experience as such. Perceptual experience sometimes misleads perceivers into making erroneous judgments on its basis. The perceptual experience is of an object bearing an effish look, and if that inclines the perceiver to believe that the object is eff when it isn't, the error is in the downstream belief, not in the perceptual experience. Error resides not in the perceptual experience itself, but in post-perceptual judgments made on its basis. What is attributed is not the quality designated by the adjective reddish, but rather a reddish look. And illusions are just opportunities for being misled. As Janone puts it, conditions in the environment can contribute to objects appearing in ways that lead us to believe that they have properties they lack. The motivating idea here is that there's no straightforward argument in favour of representationalism, this is Janone, continuing with Janone, based on the need to account for perceptual error, because a relational theory of perception can explain how appearances can be misleading while denying that perceptual error is so much as possible. The assumption is that if perceptual experience can be either veridical or erroneous, then it must sustain conditions of satisfaction, and conditions of satisfaction only arise when there's representational content. The early Nya philosophers whose ideas I've been discussing are, however, unique among naive realists in denying the no perceptual error thesis. They claim a way to reconcile naive realism with the claim that illusions are perceptual in character. As Matalal presciently states, it becomes highly counterintuitive if, in order to account for or explain the phenomenon of perceptual illusion, we simply say that there is no perceptual illusion for which explanation may be needed. The earliest statement of the new view is again in Vatsyayana, the first commentator. He writes, "The imputed feature is determinately experienced in a location as this in that. So the tree stump, which, though not a person, is determinately experienced as a person, is the location of the imputed feature. If there isn't a perception of a person, there would be no determinative experience of what is not a person as a person. So too, in the determinative experience of dreams, such as I saw an elephant or I saw a mountain, an imputed feature must be determinately experienced in a location." So the Nya philosopher seeks an account of illusion in which, when an object looks F, both O and F are perceived, where F is not a representational feature, still less a quali, but a real property instance existing mind independently in the world. Evidently, it's not a property instance in the environment of the perceiver. And so the Nya move is to claim that there is an experiential relation which acquaints perceivers with property instances of objects that are absent. The error in perceptual error is one of seeing a property instance, which is a real feature of another absent object, in the object before one in one's environment. So the Nya analysis of illusion is therefore appropriately called a mislocation theory of error, Anyata Khyativada. How can an object look a way it is not? Nyaya, writes Motilal, invokes the service of past experience and memory. The revived memory triggered by the similarity of a shared character brings in its wake the object of the past experience. And in this way, it appears in perception, or rather misperception, as a characteristic or qualifier. These features are not sense impressions private to the percipient, but rather, in most cases, observable features of the external world. Thus, in its simplest form, the mislocation theory asserts that error or perceptual illusion is the mislocation of a real F in a real X. The basic assumption in this theory is that nothing appears in our visual perceptual awareness which is not also existent or real. So the Nya view consists in the following tenets. One, that all illusions are, illusions are always partial or anchored. Two, that we have perceptual access to features of objects not in our present environment. Let me call that the anomalous acquaintance with absent features tenet. And three, that perceptual error is error in allocation, now to be understood in terms of the binding in attention of the feature presented in two with the anchor presented in one. Let me call that feature binding error. I'm going to say more about both of these two tenets. But briefly, the idea is as follows. It's that past perceptual encounters with snakes or pieces of silver have the following explanatory role with respect to my current illusory experience. They are activated in such a way that I now seem to see, in an object before me, a property with which they anomalously acquaint me. The claim is that an earlier perception, which consists in seeing a locatee located in a locus, makes available to me now that same locatee for potential visual mislocation in a currently perceived locus. In other words, what distinguishes genuine perception and illusion is that the feature whose role it is to be located by experience in a currently perceived object is itself perceptually presented in the case of genuine perception, but is retrieved in memory in illusion. Perceptions and illusions are subjectively indistinguishable, nevertheless, because the distinction between these two acquaintance mechanisms is not an introspectable one. The mechanism driving illusion, according to this account, is essentially the same as the one responsible for recognition, a retrieval of a previously stored feature and its imputation in a present case. Illusions, according to this analysis, are misfires of the same perceptual recognitional system that is operative in all cases of seeing in. They are, for this reason, not veridical, but but their lack of veridicality does not derive either from their consisting in false beliefs or from their belonging to another non-perceptual mental kind. So we arrive at a theory of perceptual illusion which, while holding firm to naive realist scruples, is neither disjunctivist nor doxastic. Illusions are indeed, after all, perceptual errors. There is indeed, after all, a common factor in perception and illusion. But the common factor is a mind-independent property, the pradana, and not a representational content. And that's how Nyaya realism can be a non-disjunctivist version of naive realism, and why Burge was wrong when he declared that naive realism entails disjunctivism. Okay, well, let me now say more about the second tenet, the anomalous acquaintance with absent features tenet. The mislocation theory of illusion claims that anomalous relations of acquaintance acquaint perceivers with features not currently instantiated in their environments, and that illusions are feature-binding errors wherein an anomalously presented feature is bound with a normally presented object. This is how the terms pradana, imputed feature or look, and adhyaropa, imputation, are now to be understood. The novelty of the Nyaya view consists in how it provides a way to defend naive realism against the problem of illusion without resort to disjunctivism. Nyaya philosophers do so through their claim, about which they're emphatic, that the feature presented in an illusion, which is to say the way the perceived object looks, is itself given perceptually, albeit by way of a non-standard mode of perceptual acquaintance. It would be very hard to claim, given that both the object and the way it looks are given perceptually, that the resulting illusion nevertheless does not belong to a perceptual mental kind. Neither, however, is error exported to downstream belief. It's the perceptual experience itself which misbinds locus and locati. How should we justify such an appeal to a concept of anomalous acquaintance? One way is to demonstrate that it's needed in the explanation of perceptual phenomena other than illusion. And that is indeed the Nyaya strategy. So consider what we should say about the perceptual experience of a synesthete. Their perceptual experience locates in an object presented in one sense modality, a sensory feature properly restricted to another. The idea that illusion can be modelled on synesthesia is due to Gangesha, who provides the example of seeing fragrant sandalwood, and also emphasises the mediating role of memory. And the idea is most fully developed by Rama Rudra in his commentary on Bhasha Paricheda, Karaka 64. It's cited as an example of genuine perceptual experience, wherein what occurs is that the subject sees in an object visually present before them, a sensible feature properly restricted to another sensory modality, and retrieved in memory. It's genuine because, after all, the sandalwood is fragrant. So Matalal writes, it's contended by Nyar that even such reports as I see sweet honey, or I see fragrant flowers, or I see cold ice, would be correct reports of visual perception as long as the particular, the nucleus of the object complex, is visually presented. In these cases, the attributive or qualifying element, sweetness or fragrant, may not be the objects of the visual perception in the ordinary manner, but the mind picks it out from the memory bank, and this revived awareness presents it to the visual faculty. The sense and the object get connected here, though not in the normal way. In this way, the resulting awareness becomes perceptual. Hence the correct report, I see the fragrant jasmine. The example refers to what would now be classified as a case of projective synesthesis, in which the inducer is vision and the concurrent is smell. While by no means the most common sort of synesthesia, most cases involving a colour concurrent induced by graphemes or sounds, vision colour synesthesia is empirically observed and accounts for over 1% of cases, with vision temperature around 0.35% and vision flavour nearly 3% of empirically observed cases of synesthesia. Moreover, the claim that cases of synesthesia are genuinely perceptual is widely supported in the literature on synesthesia. Robertson describes them as perceptual experiences involving an unusual binding. And Cohen writes that one of the central outstanding puzzles about synesthesia, and one that's at least partly to blame for the recent surge in attention given to the condition by philosophers and psychologists, is that of understanding the relationship between synesthetic perception and normal perception. And he goes on to argue that, given what we know about both, the most plausible view is that synesthesia is not a fundamentally distinct pathological outlier relative to normal perception. Rather, it's best understood as continuous with capacities present in normal perception. Synesthesia is naturally expressed in the vocabulary of looks. It's not a big leap to move from expressions such as you look cold to ones such as it looks cold, said of a visually selected physical object. In fact, Wilfred Sellers extends his Kantian image-based account of a modal completion I mentioned last week to exactly such synesthetic effects. He writes, consider the snow seen on a distant mountain. It looks cool. Do we see the whiteness of the snow but only believe in its coolness? Perhaps this is sometimes so, but surely not always. Sometimes actual coolness is present in the experience, as was the white inside the apple or the red on the opposite side. That's the modal completion cases. Once again, we do not see the coolness of the snow. We see the snow as cool, and we experience the actual coolness as we experience the actual whiteness of the snow. An actual coolness is bodily present in the experience, as is an actual volume of white. Let's combine our results into a single example. We see the cool red apple. We see it as red on the facing side, as red on the opposite side, and as containing a volume of cool white apple flesh. We do not see of the apple its opposite side, or its inside, or its internal whiteness, or its coolness, or its juiciness. But while these features are not seen, they're not merely believed in. These features are present in the object of perception as actualities. They're present in virtue of being imagined. So Sellers rejects Gibson-type and belief-based accounts of both amodal completion and synesthesis in favour of an imagery-based view. The Nya philosopher, however, wants to offer a relational account of both. Here again, the locution of seeing as obscures matters, for it's not clear what's meant in saying that one sees the ice as cold. Rather, what we need is the language of location. One sees coldness in the ice. Anya realists insist that the experiential relation obtains between a subject and ordinary macroscopic objects, and also that it obtains between a subject and the properties of such objects. So it is that one sees in the jasmine its whiteness, and one smells in the jasmine its fragrance. The synesthete is not currently smelling the jasmine, they're only seeing it, and their experience is not cross-modal. Yet the fragrance they see the jasmine as having is not a mental image superimposed onto the jasmine. It's not a case of make-perceive. If we recall that feature location is a matter of access rather than selection, it's clear that what the Nya realist needs is an account of the sort of access the subject who sees the jasmine has to the sensible properties of the flower in other modalities. For it's not the case that just because one sense modality, in this case vision, provides the basis for the selection of the object, only properties in that same sense modality can be accessed. A purely visual experience of the jasmine can enable access to features of the jasmine in other sense modalities. Instead, if one's visual attention to those properties is served by mechanisms of retrieval. The Nya philosopher wants to claim that the mechanism of retrieval is not underwritten by representation, either in the form of belief or imagery, but itself constitutes a sui generis experiential relation holding between the subject and the feature in question, in this case, the jasmine scent. So it's called, technically, jnana lakshana pratyasati, or cognitively demarcated presentation. As I understand it, what this means is that what makes an illusion cognitive is not the projection of a concept or image, but the exercise of a cognitively demarcated mode of attention. As Motilal stresses, Nya takes all these cases of synesthesia as cases of perception, and veridical cases at that. Thus it is that the model of memory presentation and non-physical connection is invoked not simply to explain the problem of sensory illusion. In other words, the model is not devised in desperation to save realism from the argument from illusion. The model has more explanatory power, for it explains standard cases of illusion as well as some cases of veridical perception, namely synesthesis. Now let me turn to the other tenet, the one to do with feature binding error. Well, in an amusing passage, Austin Clark explains why an ancient picture of the mentor as a mere flow of qualia must face up to a binding problem. He writes, "Consider a humble animal whose consciousness stops at sentience. One imagines its mental life to consist in nothing but a flux of sensory qualities. In a widely repeated and ancient image, its stream of mental processes is filled by variegated qualia, which over time pop up, bob along, combine, recombine, and ultimately sink back down into the muck. A mental life of pure sensation will be nothing but a stream, flux, a flow of such stuff. But this picture, ancient and widely repeated as it is, radically underestimates the sophistication needed of even the simplest animal. An animal whose mental life is a pure flux of qualities could not distinguish matte red next to glossy green from matte green next to glossy red. The ability to do this marks a significant threshold in the complexity of one's psychological organization. To pass it, one needs somehow to focus the attribution of qualities so that one can distinguish a scene containing a red square from one containing something that's red and something else that's square. Well, the ancient image is certainly a Buddhist one, familiar from early sources such as the Nikaya and the Milinda Panha. And the problem here referred to is a version of what Frank Jackson calls the many properties problem. A problem about the way features get to be bound or integrated. A creature with only the capacities to discriminate red from green and matte from gloss could not distinguish between the two scenarios mentioned. They both represent the same bundles of qualities. Unless a sentient creature could solve this problem, it would also not be able to distinguish a single chirp from two simultaneously and qualitatively identical chirps coming from different directions. In fact, the capacity to do this falls well below the capacity to employ concepts, and that's still another reason to reject the Kant-Strawson thesis. The greatest advances in contemporary understanding of the nature of attention and its role in feature binding have been due to the work of Anne Treisman, and her most recent articulations can help us understand the Nyaya claim that perceptual illusions consist in the misallocation of an anomalously perceived feature in a normally perceived locus. Treisman notes that there can be what she calls illusory conjunctions. She writes, "Focal attention provides the glue which integrates the initially separable features into unitary objects. Once they've been correctly registered, the compound objects continue to be perceived and stored as such. However, with memory decay or interference, the features may disintegrate and float free once more, or perhaps recombine to perform illusory conjunctions." On this view, Treisman says, attention provides a window for consciousness through which we become aware of a small subset of real bindings among a throng of illusory phantom objects. So we have an account of feature binding errors and their role in generating illusions. In illusion, visual attention opens out onto phantom bindings of real features, attention misallocates the real feature to the real object. So the Nya story about illusion is that perceptual attention binds a feature and an object together. The object being one with which one is acquainted in one's immediate environment, and the feature being an absent feature with which one is anomalously acquainted. Just as in synesthesia, a feature is anomalously presented, because presented in a sense modality distinct from the modality of object acquaintance. So in the case of illusion, a misfiring of the mechanism of feature binding takes place. As Masalan sums it up, the mind takes the wrong signal from the physical sensory reaction and picks out a wrong qualifying element from the memory bank, and this revived awareness generates the non-veridical perceptual awareness, which may be reported as, "This is a snake," or "I see a snake." In such cases, we wrongly attribute a qualifying element to a perceived particular, an element that's not present in the external state of affairs. This is still a perceptual error, according to Nya, for part of the sensorily perceived object complex is picked out by the visual sense faculty, while the other part is supplied by revived memory. In fact, the nucleus is sensorily given in the ordinary way, while the attributive elements are given in an out-of-the-ordinary way. That's why they call it alaukika pratyaksha. So in sum, illusions are misfirings in bindings due to failures of attention. Their proper explanation doesn't appeal to the idea that there's a projection of mental imagery onto the external world, let alone that they consist in beliefs formed downstream of the perceptual encounter. An attention-based account of perceptual illusion is fully naive, realist in character. And the right way to cash out the metaphor with which we began, that of the burdening or imputing the adhyaropa of the nucleus of a perceptual experience with a perceived feature, is not in terms of notions such as projection and conceptualization, but is strictly a phenomenon of attention. Now, let me compare this account with a couple of contemporary theories of illusion. According to Bill Brewer, we should define a visual illusion as an experience in which a physical object O looks F, although O is not actually F. And he then claims that illusions come about in cases in which the direct objects of experience have such similarities with paradigm exemplars of kinds of which they are not themselves instances. More exactly, he writes, in a case of visual illusion in which a mind-independent physical object O looks F, although O is not actually F, O is the direct object of visual perception from a spatio-temporal point of view, and in circumstances of perception relative to which O has visually relevant similarities with paradigm exemplars of F, although it is not itself actually an instance of F. Brewer considers two examples. First, what about the illusion in which a straight stick looks bent if half submerged in water? Brewer writes that here the direct object of perception is that very straight stick. Nevertheless, it looks bent in virtue of its visually relevant similarities with an unsubmerged bent stick that has its top half coincident with the unsubmerged half of the stick seen and its bottom half in the position of the relevant virtual image of the bottom half of the latter from the subject's point of view, and given the refractive index of the liquid in question. How about a white piece of chalk illuminated with red light, thereby looking red? Brewer's proposal is that the perceptual experience in question is most fundamentally a matter of the subject's conscious acquaintance with that very piece of chalk itself, a particular persisting, mind-independent physical object. From the viewpoint in question, and most importantly in this case given the relevant perceptual circumstances, especially of course the abnormally red illumination, it has visually relevant similarities with a paradigm red piece of chalk of just that size and shape. Their visually relevant similarity consists in the similarity of the light reflected from both. Thus, the white chalk looks red. On a Brewer-style analysis of the examples the Indians are most fond of, the coiled rope misperceived as a snake, and the shiny piece of shell misperceived as a piece of silver, would run as follows. In either case, the perceiver is consciously acquainted with a mind-independent physical object, a coil of rope, a shiny piece of shell, which has visually relevant similarities with paradigm exemplars of the kind it looks to be. In the first case, the visually relevant similarity is one of shape. The rope's coiling is visually similar to the shape of a paradigmatic coiled snake. In the second case, the visually relevant similarity, just as in the red-looking chalk example, consists in the similarity of the light reflected from both the shiny shell and a paradigmatic piece of silver. The Neuer mislocation theory shares with Brewer's analysis of illusion two important points. First, both are committed to the naive realist thesis that even in illusory experience, there is a mind-independent object with which one stands in a non-representational relation of perceptual acquaintance. In Neuer terminology, that's the adhara, the object which serves as the location for a misplaced property. The rope and the piece of shell are real mind-independent objects, perceptually present to the observer. Second, the Neuer theory too appeals to the notion of visually relevant similarities with instances of the kind which this object looks to be. In the Neuer theory, we find a reference to instances of snakehood and silverhood, instances with which the observer has been in past perceptual contact. On the other hand, there's a considerable difference when it comes to the exact role ascribed to these instances of the kind F by the two analyses of illusion. Just what does Brewer mean when he speaks about paradigms of a physical kind? He elaborates the notion as follows. The paradigms, he says, are instances of the kind in question whose association with the terms for those kinds partly constitutes our understanding of those terms, given our training in the acquisition of the relevant concepts. They're paradigm exemplars of the kinds in question relative to our grasps of the concepts for those kinds. There is in Neuer epistemology a version of this idea, in their idea that we acquire an understanding of kind terms by our acquaintance with specimens of the kind, identified under descriptions of the form, this is similar to X. The whole process is given the name upamana, usually, if unhelpfully, translated as analogy. Yet that is not the role which the mislocation theory assigns to instances of the kind F, the kind which an object looks to be in an illusion. The role rather is one of previous acquaintance grounding an ascriptional skill. I visually recognise snake in the rope as a result of my previous exposure to snakes. We must be careful, therefore, to distinguish between two roles that instances of a kind can play in perceptual experience. One is to serve as the paradigmatic exemplars of the kind through which we learn a concept of and a name for the kind. The other is to serve as the grounding experience for an ascriptional skill, an ascriptional capacity with respect to further instances of the kind in question, a skill that can and sometimes does misfire. And these two roles can come apart. For example, I might have acquired my concept snake and my mastery of the term snake by being shown pictures of snakes in a picture book. I might also have seen snakes coiled and uncoiled in the countryside or the zoo. And it could be that the relevant similarity, when I am now subject to an illusion in which a piece of rope looks to be a snake, is with such past perception and not with the picture book paradigmatic cases involved in my acquisition of understanding. In short, the Nyaya mislocation account does not restrict the domain of instances of the kind F to those whose role is in concept or language acquisition. And for the reason I've just given, that does seem right. Brewer's account of illusion is overly restrictive. It will fail to explain all those cases of illusion where the relevant similarity is with an instance of the kind F which has no role in the perceiver's acquisition of the concept. Now, a different option for the naive realist is to argue, as we've seen several authors do, that there are, strictly speaking, no such thing as perceptual illusions. In any case where an object appears F, it's objectively the case that the object looks F-ish, where the F-ish look worn by the object is as much an objective, albeit situational, property of that object as any of its other properties. So Louise Anthony writes, "The feature that's actually present in our experience of a straight stick in water is a feature that infallibly corresponds to a property the stick actually does possess, namely the objective feature of objective sticks that triggers visual systems like ours to produce the particular kind of percept it produces. We lack a name for this property, but could call it bentishness. Our experience, therefore, does not have the content, the stick is bent. It rather presents to us a bentish stick, something that it can't fail to do, given the openness of perception and the manifest bentishness of the stick." There's a way in which we can read the Buddhist Dignaga as a theorist of this sort. It's possible to read him as combining the idea that appearances are objective with the idea that perceptual error is a matter of mistaken judgment. Dignaga says that perception is free from kalpana, kalpana meaning imagination, but more broadly, any sort of representation, conceptualization, or judgment. As for perceptual error, he says that erroneous cognition is not a true perception because it arises conceptually constructing, for example, water out of such things as vapour floating over sand. And he adds that cognition of empirical reality is not a true perception because it superimposes something extraneous upon things that are only empirically true and thus functions through the conceptualization of forms of these extraneous things. For Dignaga, perception is pure acquaintance with a category of objects he calls svalakshana, and as such is error-free. And his term for the way such objects look is vishayakara. What we think of as perceptual error consists in the conceptualizations we make downstream in the intellectual process he calls inference or anumana. Dignaga's extreme view is that every such downstream judgment is mistaken. And that's why I'm tempted to describe Dignaga, as I did in the first lecture, as an infallible relationist about perceptual experience. And as we've seen in the second lecture, Dharmakirti transforms Dignaga's infallibilism into an imagery-based version of representationalism. Now, let me just conclude by segueing into next week's talk. Ujjo Thakura has said that all illusion involves masking the truth of the object, that it is a coiled rope, is masked in an illusion which sees it as a snake. What then, in general, unmasks illusions? How are illusions to be dispelled? Not by judgment, because illusions are frequently insensitive to belief. So then the dispeller must be another perception, and the most general form of illusion dispelling perception is the experience of absence. The experience of the absence of a snake dispels the illusion of the rope as a snake. So it's for that reason that it's the nature of absence experience that I'm going to turn to next week. Thank you very much.